Today is Wednesday, December 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, dozens of Afghan women stage a protest in Kabul demanding rights under the Taliban rule.
All the policies that they have announced over the past few days limiting women's rights have definitely raised a lot of questions about Taliban's commitments that they have made with the global community.
Syria accuses Israel of a rocket attack that set off a major fire in the port area of Latakia.
Syrian TV showed fire crews trying to extinguish a massive blaze early Tuesday in the port region of the coastal city of Latakia.
And Mali's military government denies hiring Russian mercenaries from the controversial Wagner Group. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Dozens of Afghan women staged a protest in Kabul on Tuesday demanding their rights under Taliban rule. The women marched down the streets chanting, quote, "Why have you closed schools," unquote, and, quote, "We want work, food and education," unquote. The protests followed a new Taliban decree on women's rights issued by the Ministry of Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice on Sunday. It dictates women traveling for more than 72 kilometers should be accompanied by a male family member. During its previous rule from 1996 to 2001, the Taliban banned women from leaving their house without a male relative and full face and head covering. The government also banned girls from receiving an education and severely limited employment opportunities for women. The Taliban says they have changed and are working on getting more girls back to school after allowing high school for girls in some provinces to open, but many women and rights advocates remain skeptical. The Taliban has been under pressure from the international community, who have mostly frozen funds for Afghanistan to commit to upholding women's rights since the hardline Islamists took over the country on August 15. Analysts say the group's latest decree that women be accompanied by male relatives on trips dents the image of tolerance and inclusiveness the Taliban has been trying to project. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gar.
All these policies or rules that they have announced over the past few days limiting women's rights have definitely raised a lot of questions about Taliban's commitments that they have made with the global community, that they will respect human rights, especially women's rights, and that they will govern the country in an inclusive manner. So if you look at the policies that they have announced over the past week, definitely going back to their controversial governance of the 1990s, when they had definitely barred women from public life and girls from receiving an education. And if this continues like this, obviously it will force the United States and other countries to delay, even if they wanted to engage directly in terms of providing humanitarian assistance to Afghanistan, rather than even discussing anything like giving diplomatic recognition to the Taliban. So obviously, their case has been seriously undermined. You know, I have spoken to Taliban and I have spoken to people in Kabul. There's also a perception that it could be an attempt to increase their bargaining position, because they know that the world community is desperate to provide humanitarian assistance to Afghans who desperately need it. So the Taliban are trying to come up with these old policies, harsh policies, basically to maybe raise their bargaining.
In the face of harsh winter, shortages of food, medicine, what would be the advantage for the Taliban to even contemplate this action? You said it's a message, but to who?
Well, that's the dilemma that the international community faces currently, because if they just refuse to engage with the Taliban or isolate them, this is a government. But then what will happen to more than 23 million Afghans who are basically facing acute hunger? And there are millions of children who suffer from acute malnutrition. So if those Afghans, if they start suffering seriously and if they're their deaths occurring, obviously Western countries will come under pressure and will be blamed for creating this mess. So the question for the international community is whether to abandon these millions of Afghans or engage with the Taliban. And if they engage with the Taliban, obviously they will be supporting these harsh policies that the Taliban are implementing. So it's really unclear as to why the Taliban would take these actions despite their pledges that they will respect human rights. This could also be an attempt by the Taliban to send the message to their followers in Afghanistan, to Taliban fighters, low-ranking fighters and officials, that they are sticking to their ideological belief that Islam must be observed strictly the way Taliban are interpreting it, whether the world gives them aid or not. So this could be just a public posturing.
What do you make of the comment by some Taliban official that to the extent that the women are able and allowed to protest means there is space and there is rights for people to disagree and also make their views known?
At this moment, if you look at all the actions that the Taliban have taken, they clearly are aimed at consolidating their position, their government, and their hold on the country. So whatever treatment their women are being meted out, or the policies or statements that the Taliban are doing, are all aimed at sending a strong message to whoever is opposing their rule inside Afghanistan that they are here and that they will not allow any freedom of expression, even if they don't get support or recognition from the international communities.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gul speaking with me from Islamabad. Syria's media is accusing Israel of a rocket attack that set off a major fire in the port city of Laqiya early Tuesday, damaging a large number of shipping containers. Arab media claims that Israel destroyed a number of containers transporting Iranian weapons. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Syrian TV showed fire crews trying to extinguish a massive blaze early Tuesday in the port region of the coastal city of Latakia after a rocket or missile barrage hit a shipping container depot. Syria accused Israel of the attack. Israel did not immediately confirm responsibility. Another attack on the same Syrian port facility on December 7 reportedly targeted an Iranian missile shipment, according to Israeli TV. Israel has reportedly struck targets inside Syria at least 31 times during the past year, according to Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV. Syrian military officials in the region of Latakia denied that any weapons were struck in Tuesday's rocket attack. Colonel Jalal Dawood, an officer in charge of the area, told state TV the target was mainly economic. He says the rocket strike is part of an ongoing series of attacks and it is a blow to the economy and the well-being of the Syrian people. He claims the containers that were hit held industrial goods and foodstuffs. Rami Abdulrahman, who heads the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, told Arab media that some of the shipping containers destroyed in the attack were filled with weapons, although it was not clear what type. He also claims that Russia, which has a major airbase 15 kilometers north of Latakia, refused to allow its S-300 air defense systems to intercept rockets used in the attack. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that Russia is in tacit agreement with attacks on the alleged Iranian arms shipments. He says that Israel's Channel 10 TV reported the December 7 attack on Latakia was aimed at a container carrying Iranian cruise missiles that had just arrived at the port, hitting it immediately, while Tuesday's attack most likely hit another container with a similar arms shipment. He adds there is a major dispute between Iran and Russia over the use of Latakia for arms shipments. Abu Diab went on to say that a number of other suspicious explosions took place Tuesday, although it is not clear who was behind them. One explosion reportedly took place at a Palestinian refugee camp near Homs, while a second reportedly struck an arms depot in the Damascus suburb of Douma. Al Arabiya TV showed amateur video of an explosion in the pro-Iranian Hezbollah stronghold of Nabishit in Lebanon's eastern Bekaa Valley. Hezbollah claimed the blast was caused by a rocket that accidentally detonated.
Former Syrian Army Colonel Ahmed Rahal told Arabiya TV, the Bou Kamel-Syrian border crossing with Iraq is becoming a major passageway for incoming Iranian weapons, while Latakia is becoming a key gateway for Iranian weapons arriving by sea. He asserted the amount of damage to the port of Latakia Tuesday shows the alleged weapon shipment must have been pretty large. Fires burned out of control in Latakia's port area for nearly 8 hours before being extinguished. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Mali's military government has denied hiring Russian mercenaries from the controversial Wagner Group, which has been sanctioned by the European Union for rights abuses. France and 15 other Western nations last week condemned what they said was Russia's deployment of Wagner fighters to Mali. Mali's transitional government says it is only engaged with official Russian military trainers. Analysts weigh in on Russia's military involvement in the country as French troops are drawing down in this report by Annie Rosenberg from Mali's capital, Bamako.
Mali's transitional government this month denied what it called a baseless allegations that it hired the controversial Russian security firm, the Wagner Group, to help fight Islamist insurgents. Western governments and UN experts have accused Wagner of rights abuses, including killing civilians, in the Central African Republic and Libya. The response came Friday after Western nations made the accusations, which Mali's military government dismissed with a demand that they provide independent evidence. A day earlier, France and 15 other Western nations had condemned what they called the deployment of Wagner mercenaries to Mali. The joint statement said they deeply regret the transitional authorities' choice to use already scarce public funds to pay foreign mercenaries instead of supporting its own armed forces and the Malian people. The statement also called on the Russian government to behave more responsibly, accusing it of providing material support to the Wagner Group's deployment, which Moscow denies. The Mali government acknowledged what it called Russian trainers were in the country. It said they were present to help strengthen the operational capacities of their defense and security forces. Ali Tunkarda is director of the Center for Security and Strategic Studies in the Sahel, a Bamako-based think tank. He says it's hard to tell if the Russian security presence is military or mercenary, but regardless, would likely be supporting rather than frontline fighting. This could allow the Malian army to have victories over the enemy that will be attributed to them, says Tunkarda, which was not the case with the French forces. He says the second advantage is that the victories over the extremists could allow Mali's military to legitimize itself. We must remember, says Tunkarda, that one of the reasons for the forced departure of President Keita was that the security situation was so bad. Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, was overthrown in an August 2020 coup led by Colonel Assimi Goïta after months of anti-government protests, much of it over worsening security. Goïta launched a second coup in May that removed the interim government leaders, but has promised to hold elections in 2022. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has been pushing Mali's military government to hold elections. ECOWAS in November expressed concern over a potential Wagner Group deployment to Mali after unconfirmed reports that the military government was in talks with the mercenary group. Popular protests in Bamako have called for French forces to leave Mali, and last year some protesters were seen calling for Russian ones to intervene. Since French forces first arrived in Mali in 2013, public opinion on their presence has shifted from favorable to widely negative. The French military has been gradually drawing down its anti-insurgent Operation Barkhane forces from the Sahel region. French forces this year withdrew from all but one military base in northern Mali, saying the Malian armed forces were ready to take the lead on their own security. But analysts say one consequence of the French leaving is that the Malian army is seeking other partners. Boubacar Salif Traoré is director of AfriGlobe Conseil, a Bamako-based development and security consulting firm.
Cette coopération va beaucoup...
Official Russian cooperation would be very advantageous for the Malian army in terms of supplying equipment, he says. Traoré says Mali and many African countries, notably the Central African Republic, have concluded that France does not play fair in terms of delivering arms. Every time these states ask for weapons, he says, either there's an embargo or there's a problem in procuring these weapons. Traoré says Russia can provide these weapons without constraints, and it's precisely that which interests Mali. In September, Mali received 4 military helicopters and other weapons bought from Russia. The Malian transitional government's statement Friday did not elaborate on what the Russian trainers would be doing in Mali. When asked for comment, a government spokesman would not elaborate and referred questions to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which does not list any contact numbers on its website. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
President Biden has signed legislation that approves nearly $770 billion in military spending and provides pay raises to service members in the coming year. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The National Defense Authorization Act came together through intense negotiations by Democrats and Republicans, who had to compromise over issues ranging from military justice reform in sexual assault cases to COVID vaccine requirements. The authorization provides a 5% increase in military spending to $768 billion and includes a pay raise of 2.7% for military personnel. The measure also includes $7 billion for the Pacific Deterrence Initiative with a statement of support for Taiwan and $300 million for Ukraine security, a show of support in the face of Russian aggression. I'm Jackie Quinn.
10 years after Kim Jong-un assumed power, North Korea is better armed but deeply isolated and more dependent on China. This despite actions by the young leader that raised and dashed hopes of economic transformation or international opening. Jason Abano, Reuters reports.
It's been 10 years since Kim Jong-un became leader of North Korea. He marks the third generation of his family to rule the reclusive state. At times throughout the last decade, the youngest Kim's actions have raised and ruined hopes of economic transformation or opening up. Let's take a look at his legacy so far. Kim Jong-un was born in the early 80s. He was hailed as the great successor after his father, Kim Jong-il, died of a heart attack in 2011. But before that, the young Kim was shrouded in mystery. Kim's reign so far has come to be defined by one thing: nuclear weapons. Four of the North's six nuclear tests have been conducted under Kim Jong-un's eye, along with numerous ballistic launches.
The entire United States is within range of our nuclear weapons, and a nuclear button is always on my desk.
But Kim's fixation on nuclear weapons has come with a heavy price. As a result, the UN and others have slapped tough economic sanctions on his country. That stands in the way of a political breakthrough needed to improve a shattered economy and prevent millions from starving.
North Korea has been working towards two huge goals: strengthening national defense and improving living standards. I think the living situation got worse because of sanctions and the pandemic.
Kim seemed to embrace a different style than his father. He sought to win international respect and sanctions relief through summits with foreign leaders who repeatedly called for the North to denuclearize. This even led to unprecedented meetings between Kim and then U.S. President Donald Trump. But talks with America have since stalled.
They wanted the sanctions lifted in their entirety, and we couldn't do that.
Soon after, the North conducted its first missile test in years. At least Kim had one ally in the U.S. who supported him.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Kim is known for displays of care towards everyday people in state media. But among those that have defected, some say that is just a facade.
Kim is emulating his grandfather because many people miss the past. So he tried to look and dress similar to his grandfather and shed tears while giving speeches. That's cosplay.
In reality, to tighten his grip on society, Kim seemed intent on continuing his father's worst practices. Executions, including reportedly against his own family members, to political prison camps and cracking down on the number of defectors. Kim has also overseen crackdowns on foreign pop culture as he seeks to stamp out influence from overseas. At least seven people have been put to death under him for watching or distributing K-pop videos, according to a Seoul-based human rights group. Analysts say North Korea under Kim Jong-un is better armed, but more isolated. Sanctions and lockdowns have left Pyongyang over-reliant on China, with which it has a distrustful but vital relationship. Kim will have to make hard decisions over whether to trade any of his arsenal to win sanctions relief or find other ways to boost the economy, such as allowing more international opening, without losing political grip.
That's Jason Albano of Reuters. Since an artist garnered $69 million earlier this year for digital artwork tied to blockchain technology, artists and fans have taken an increasing interest in so-called non-fungible tokens. Tina Trin exposed the technology that's disrupting the art world.
The worlds of art and technology were on display at a recent show in New York City.
I think the best and most talented artists have always looked to technology, to new formats, to be able to take their art to the next level.
That includes turning digital art into non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, digital collectibles linked to blockchains, encrypted distributed ledgers that validate their origins and authenticity. Liz Yang works at Definity, a nonprofit with its own blockchain network called the Internet Computer. Definity helps artists turn their works into NFTs, which are minted, traded, and sold on the platform.
From a provenance perspective, you would know exactly like where the art originated from and where it's been sold, like into perpetuity, essentially.
That's important for digital art, which is typically easy to copy. Owners of NFTs hold the authorized original art in a digital wallet. In addition to giving digital artists more exposure, NFTs allow them to make money in different ways.
There are a lot of cases where artists sell art at a time where they're not that famous, and then later on down the line in the secondary markets, the art sells for many, many multiples more, but they don't reap any of the rewards.
Blockchain platforms use smart contracts that are programmed to execute transactions based on certain conditions.
Because it's code, you can stipulate in the code that artists receive a percentage cut of every secondary market transaction thereafter.
Critics say the buzz around NFTs make it a highly speculative market, and it remains to be seen whether the current movement is a bubble that will eventually burst. Still, artists like Neil White are excited for the new medium.
It's pretty fun to kind of feel like I'm sort of making art in like a more like futuristic form.
And that future may well be filled with NFTs. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
In other news, Sudanese authorities say at least 38 people were killed when a defunct gold mine collapsed in West Kordofan province. The country's state-run mining company said in a statement, the collapse of the closed, non-functioning mine took place Tuesday in a village 700 kilometers south of the capital, Khartoum. The mining company posted images on Facebook showing villagers gathering at the site as at least two dredgers worked to find possible survivors and bodies. The company said the mine is not functional, but local miners returned to work it after forces guarding the site left the area. It did not say when the mine stopped working. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Apo in Washington. A televised speech Monday night by Lebanon's president delivered veiled criticism of Iran-backed Hezbollah, but analysts said has done little to resurrect support among his followers and other Lebanese. Michel Aoun is urging parliament to get back to work, but has refused to call out political heavyweight Hezbollah and its Shiite party ally, Amar, over their chokehold on the legislature and the judicial inquiry into the deadly 2020 Beirut port explosion. For VOA, Dave Gavlak reports.
President Michel Aoun, a Maronite Christian, and Hezbollah have shaped Lebanon's politics for 16 years. He warned that an 11-week parliamentary boycott has kept the government from meeting and undermined state institutions amid the country's economic meltdown. But he fell short of directly criticizing his ally Hezbollah and the Shiite Amal Party in his speech. Both have blocked cabinet meetings since October over their demands for the dismissal of Judge Tariq Bitar, who is investigating the Beirut port explosion that killed more than 200 people in August 2020. So far, no one has been held accountable for the incident, which was one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history. Hezbollah and Amal accuse Bitar of bias, but observers say he is just doing his job by questioning ministers responsible for the port at the time. The probe has been suspended for a fourth time. Lebanese analyst Dania Holiat Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut told VOA that Aoun failed to convince the Lebanese people he can effectively confront Hezbollah and Amal.
They're trying to sideline Bitar, so he doesn't have the power to question ministers. Aoun has a dilemma. His political position by supporting Hezbollah is costing him a lot of popularity. But if he breaks with Hezbollah, who will finance him? Where will he get money? He won't have any sources to get money. So he tried to make this pinch where he says, I want law, I want the state. And then he gives the country to Hezbollah on a silver plate.
Hezbollah wields considerable political and military influence in Lebanon. It's the only militia to have held on to its weapons since the end of the 1975 to 1990 civil war. Aoun's presidency ends in 2022. His unpopular son-in-law, Gibran Basile, leader of the Free Patriotic Movement Party, or FPM, wants the job. The FPM is stuck between a rock and a hard place today. Karim Emil Bitar of Beirut St. Joseph University told the Reuters news agency. He certainly realized that the Christian Street no longer condones any form of acquiescence to Hezbollah's demands, said Bitar, who directs the university's Institute of Political Science. But they simply cannot afford to completely let go of this alliance, because it would ruin Basile's presidential ambitions and would certainly prevent them from getting a significant parliamentary bloc, he said. Analyst Khatib said many Lebanese Christian voters are now anxious to support independent civil society candidates, or Samir Jaja, who heads the Lebanese Forces political party and opposes Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement. Del Gathak for VOA News, Amman.
Somalia's opposition presidential candidates are calling on President Mohamed Abdullah Mohamed, popularly known as Farmajo, to leave office after he attempted to force the prime minister from power. Mohamed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu.
The Council of the Presidential Candidates in Somalia issued the call one day after Farmajo suspended the prime minister, Mohamed Hussein Roble, accusing him of corruption and failure to conduct elections. The prime minister has denied the allegations, accusing the president of orchestrating a coup. The opposition candidates called for an investigation into what they termed as a treason and for the National Consultative Council, consisting of the federal and other leaders from five states, to immediately address grievances about already delayed parliamentary elections. There has been no comment from Farmajo on the latest developments, which have escalated a dispute between two politicians over the delayed vote and who will lead the country. Critics say the president is looking to stay in power by any means necessary. Farmajo took office in February 2017. His term formally ended in February. The international community, including the U.S. Embassy in Mogadishu, has since urged Somali leaders to avoid violent actions and initiate dialogue to resolve their differences in order to expedite the vote. Parliamentary elections were supposed to conclude before end of the year, but are nowhere near complete, with just more than 50 members of the parliament out of 275 selected so far by the tribal delegates. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
This is Science in a Minute.
Juno is NASA's orbiting mission to Jupiter and its moons. The space agency's Juno team presented the probe's latest findings at the recent American Geophysical Union's fall meeting. Among the highlights offered included the sounds of the Jovian moon Ganymede from data that was gathered as Juno made a close flyby in June 2021. The data that generated these sounds was collected by the spacecraft's WAVES instrument, which is used to monitor electric and magnetic radio waves that are generated within Jupiter's magnetosphere. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says that Juno was within 1,038 kilometers of Ganymede's surface during the close flyby and was traveling at a relative velocity of 67,000 kilometers per hour. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afua in Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
is the voice of America. Washington, Bob Bozzi.